majesty of the multitude. But in this gospel of material success, there was no trace of that political idealism which characterizes and uplifts the American people. A very great man, President Woodrow Wilson was to call him, but not a great American. Thomas Jefferson was the product of wholly different conditions and the prophet of a rival political idea. He came from the Virginian frontier, the home of dour individualism and faith in common humanity, the nucleus of resistance to the centralizing hierarchy of British rule. Jefferson had been the principal author of the Declaration of Independence and leader of the agrarian Democrats in the American Revolution. He was well-read. He nourished many scientific interests, and he was a gifted amateur architect. His graceful classical house, Monticello, was built according to his own designs. He was in touch with fashionable left-wing circles of political philosophy in Europe, and, like the French school of economists who went by the name of physiocrats, he believed in a yeoman farmer society. He feared an industrial proletariat as much as he disliked the principle of aristocracy. Industrial and capitalist development appalled him. He despised and distrusted the whole machinery of banks, tariffs, credit manipulation, and all the agencies of capitalism which the New Yorker Hamilton was skillfully introducing into the United States. He perceived the dangers to individual liberty that might spring from the centralizing powers of a federal government. With reluctance, he came home from Paris to serve the new system. The passage of time and the stress of the Napoleonic Wars were to modify his dislike of industrialism, but he believed in his heart that democratic government was only possible among free yeomen. It was not given to him to foresee that the United States would eventually become the greatest industrial democracy in the world. "The political economists of Europe have established it as a principle," Jefferson declared, "that every state should endeavor to manufacture for itself. And this principle, like many others, we transfer to America. But we have an immensity of land, courting the industry of the husbandman. Is it best, then, that all our citizens should be employed in its improvement, or that one half should be called off from that to exercise manufactures and handicraft arts for the other? Corruption of morals in the mass of cultivators is a phenomenon of which no age nor nation has furnished an example. It is the mark set on those who, not looking up to heaven to their own soil and industry, as does the husbandman for their subsistence, depend for it on casualties and caprice of customers. Dependence begets subservience and venality, suffocates the germ of virtue, and prepares fit tools for the designs of ambition. While we have land to labor, then let us never wish to see our citizens occupied at a workbench or twirling a distaff. For the general operations of manufacture, let our workshops remain in Europe. It is better to carry provisions and material to workmen there than bring them to the provisions and materials, and with them their manners and principles. The mobs of great cities add just so much to the support of pure government as sores do to the strength of the human body. It is the manners and spirit of a people which preserve a republic in vigor. A degeneracy in these is a canker which soon eats to the heart of its laws and constitution." Jefferson held to the Virginian conception of society, simple and unassailed by the complexity, the perils, and the challenge of industrialism. In France he saw, or thought he saw, the realization of his political ideas, the destruction of a worn-out aristocracy, and a revolutionary assertion of the rights of soil-tilling man. Hamilton, on the other hand, looked to the England of the younger Pitt as the embodiment of his hopes for America. The outbreak of war between England and France was to bring to a head the fundamental rivalry and conflict between Hamilton and Jefferson, and to signalize the birth of the great American parties, Federalist and Republican. Both were to split and founder and change their names, but from them, the Republican and Democratic parties of today can trace their lineage. Chapter 3. The French Revolution. The convulsion which shook France in 1789 was totally different from the revolutions that the world had seen before. England, in the 17th century, had witnessed a violent shift in power between the crown and the people. But the basic institutions of state had been left untouched, or at any rate had soon been restored. Nor as yet had there been in England any broadening of popular sovereignty in the direction of universal suffrage. The liberties of the ordinary Englishman were well understood and had often been asserted. He could not lay claim to equality. The lack was not felt to be a very serious grievance, since the classes mingled together, and transition from one class to another was, if not easy, at least possible, and quite often achieved. America, in her revolution, had proclaimed the wider rights of mankind. Across the Atlantic shone a noble example of freedom which in the end was to exercise a formidable influence upon the world. But in the late 18th century, America's commanding future was scarcely foreseen, even by her own statesmen. In Europe, the impulse towards liberty, equality, and popular sovereignty had to come from elsewhere. It came from France. The English Revolution had been entirely a domestic affair. So, in the main, had the American. But the French Revolution was to spread out from Paris across the whole continent. It gave rise to a generation of warfare, and its echoes reverberated long into the 19th century and afterwards. Every great popular and national movement, until the Bolsheviks gave a fresh turn to events in 1917, was to invoke the principles set forth at Versailles in 1789. France, in the reign of Louis XVI, was by no means the most oppressively governed of countries, though this is often alleged. She was rich, and many of her people prospered. Why, then, did revolution break out? Volumes have been written on this subject, but one fact is clear. French political machinery in no way expressed the people's will. It did not match the times and could not move with them. It had been given its form and shape by Louis XIV. Under his majestic hands the machine had worked almost to the end. His successors inherited all his panoply of power, but none of his capacity. They could neither work the machine, nor would they alter it. At the same time, the growing middle classes in France were reaching out for the power that was withheld from them. They felt they should have a say in how they were governed. An intellectual ferment filled the land, which was denied a political outlet. An explosion was inevitable, and had long been expected by all inquiring minds. As a British official reported from Paris, the French people had been infused by a spirit of discussion of public matters which did not exist before. At some moment, the widespread frustrations of Frenchmen were bound to seek active expression. They merely needed an igniting spark. This was supplied by the royal government's incorrigible system of faulty finance. The government of France had long been bankrupt. Louis XIV had exhausted the nation in a procession of wars which had lasted for 30 years, and when he died in 1715, the public debt was more than 16 times the annual revenue. From this burden, the French never contrived to escape. Many men had laboured, but without success, to make France solvent. The obstacles were formidable. A substantial section of the population, which included the most prominent, if not always the most powerful, of French citizens, were largely exempt from taxation. Of these, the nobility numbered about 400,000. Their privileges might once have been justified by the services they'd formerly rendered to the community as landlords and military leaders, but this was no longer true. In England, the armed aristocracy had destroyed itself in the dynastic civil wars of the 15th century. France had been less well served by her history, and the French monarchy had long endured the assaults and insurrections, both real and threatened, of a warlike, virile, and ambitious nobility. Successive French kings and their ministers had been driven to policies that in the long run proved harmful. If the nobles were allowed to live on their estates, they would rebel, but if they were made to live at court, they could be supervised. Idleness and luxury were effective methods of disarmament. Both could be provided at Versailles, largely at the expense of the victims, and at Versailles most of the nobles had been compelled, or persuaded, to live. In the glitter of the great court, which at one time numbered about 200,000 people, they could squander their time and money, and the most formidable weapon they needed was the dueling sword. Thus arose a class of absentee landlords, forbidden to meddle in politics, far from their estates, unbeloved by their tenantry, yielding no services either to the soil or to the state, and drawing large and mainly untaxed profits from the lands they no longer tended. The privileges of the clergy were no less remarkable. The church owned about one-fifth of the land of France, with many valuable buildings upon it. From these sources, the ecclesiastical authorities received an annual income of perhaps £45 million. This was augmented by as much again in tithes. Yet for three generations, about 140,000 priests, monks, and nuns had paid no taxes on their properties or their fortunes. Their sanctity was as uneven as their share of the national wealth. Most of the rank and file were devout, self-denying, and upright. But a crust of politically covetous, worldly, and cynical prelates had weakened and degraded the dignity and influence of organized Christianity. The Catholic Church in France was powerless against the forces of anarchy and atheism, which, in the most cultured state in Europe, were seething and fermenting. The heaviest fiscal burden lay upon the peasants. Their plight must not be exaggerated. Since the beginning of the century, they'd been buying land, and on the eve of the explosion which was to shatter the stability of Europe and engage its peoples in a generation of mortal struggle, they owned a third of the soil of France. Nevertheless, their grievances were substantial. The tax on peasant land was nearly five times as much as on noble land. They, and they alone, paid the most hated tax of all, the taille, 53 livres in every hundred, and much abused and perverted by the tax farming to which the parched government had been compelled. A multitude of indirect taxes and impositions added their weight of misery. The winter of 1788 was very severe. Many died of starvation. Yet it has been well said that revolutions are not made by starving people. The peasants were no worse off and probably slightly more comfortable than a century before. Most of them were uninterested in politics. They desired only freedom from oppressive landlords and antiquated taxes. The revolutionary impulse came from elsewhere. The nobles had lost their energy and their faith in themselves. The clergy were divided. The army was unreliable. The king and his court lacked both the will and the ability to govern. Only the bourgeois possessed the appetite for power and the determination and self-confidence to seize it. The bourgeois were not democratic as we understand the word today. They distrusted the masses, the crowd, the mob, and with some reason, but they were nevertheless prepared to incite and use it against the privileged nobility, and if necessary, in the assertion of their own status, against the monarchy itself. Rousseau, in his famous Social Contract and other essays, had preached the theme of equality. Every man, however humble, was born with a right to play his part in the government of state. This is doctrine long since acknowledged by all democracies, but Rousseau was the first to formulate it in broad and piercing terms. Voltaire and the group of scholars and publicists who contributed to Diderot's Encyclopedia had long been casting doubt on all accepted values, religious and social. The rule of reason and the quest of knowledge for its own sake were the aims that the encyclopedists held up before Frenchmen. In the cramped political world of the old regime, these ideas worked as a powerful leaven. No one could tell in the reign of Louis XVI how far they would lead the middle classes in their pursuit of power. Unfortunately, it was not easy to capture or even discover the seat of power in 18th-century France. The country was administered by a multitude of civil servants, some paid by the government, some subsisting on the commissions and profits of their posts, some privately hired. The system had long floundered in decay and inefficiency. Files and complications flourished. A French historian, writing soon after the event, relates how it took 40 years of correspondence to mend a broken tile on a church roof. Confusion, not despotism, oppressed and exasperated the nation. And on the eve of the revolution, a minister reported to the king that the country was impossible to govern. There had been many attempts at reforming this expensive muddle, and even more to find money to pay for it. During the long reign of Louis XV, the public debt had been much reduced. When Louis XVI ascended the throne in 1774, dimly imbued with good intentions, he appointed the able and upright Turgot as Controller-General of Finance. Turgot's plans were simple, and might well have been effective if he'd been permitted to carry them out. He proposed to meet the national deficit by fierce economies in the civil service and at court. The corvée, or compulsory peasant labour on the roads, was to be abolished, together with sinecures and local customs duties. Wealth and enterprise were to be stimulated by the suppression of craft guilds or corporations, and by the promotion of internal free trade in corn. But free trade in corn led to speculation, sudden rises in the price of bread, and riots. The nobility were affronted by Turgot's attack on their privileges. Headed by the Queen, Marie Antoinette, the court denounced him as a revolutionary, and in 4 years he was dismissed. Nearly all his reforms were swept away. Their necessity was obvious. It was also obvious to the nation that their new king was incapable of carrying them out. Turgot fell in 1776, and 2 years later, France allied herself with the embattled American colonies. His disappearance solved nothing. More money was needed for war with Britain. The national deficit was 500 million livres, or about 25 million sterling. Even in those days, this was not a staggering sum. A reasonable system of taxation could have dealt with it. But where at Versailles was reason to be found? In desperation, Louis XVI made Necker, a Swiss Protestant, Director General of Finance. Necker comprehended the significance of Turgot's fate. He realized that it was impossible to touch the privileges of the nobility. He accordingly turned his energies to the reform of prisons and hospitals, and the abolition of torture for extracting confessions from suspected criminals. He did more. He set up provincial assemblies to discharge and animate the work of local government. But they were gorged with new and impractical ideas and blind hatred of the central government. They sank amid uproar, and few survived. Thwarted and disappointed, Necker resigned in May 1781. The birth of the American Republic had nonetheless inspired the mass of Frenchmen with a new taste for liberty. If the United States could achieve it, why not they? French volunteers under Lafayette and a royal army under Rochambeau had played their part in the struggle. Why must the Ancien Régime stifle the pride and energy of France? But the court remained extravagant, the administration chaotic, the treasury empty. Louis XVI, without Turgot, without Necker, and with no taste for rule and no passions beyond hunting, clockmaking, and gluttony, was left with but one expedient, to borrow. By 1785, the credit of the government was exhausted. In the following year, an assembly of notables was asked to agree to a tax on all properties alike and the abolition of fiscal privilege. The assembly refused. The notables declined to pay taxes till they knew the causes of the disaster. The clergy were adverse. They all went home. Collapse of the public administration was imminent. Paris was in riot. The Queen and the chief minister were burned in effigy. The government could raise no loans except on the promise of calling together the States General. Louis bowed to the storm. In 1788, Necker was recalled amid acclamation. He faced the urgent financial predicament, and the States General was summoned. A British Member of Parliament, visiting France at this time, prophetically wrote, "So much perturbation and heat will not easily subside. The whole kingdom seems ripe for a revolution." The States General was the Parliament of France. It had been convoked to lead the nation and support the crown at every great crisis in French history. But it had not met for 175 years. There was no living tradition to guide its conduct of business. What it might now accomplish and where its powers stopped were matters for conjecture. The king's ministers had drawn up no policy on which its deliberations could be centred. Before the deputies assembling at Versailles, there lay unlimited opportunities of decision, whether for wisdom or folly. They could set themselves to reform and regenerate France, or, through factious struggles for power, plunge the country into anarchy and war. As it happened, in less than 3 years, the States General and its successors had carried out a sweeping revolution and started a momentous European conflict. But there was no foretelling on the spring day of May the 5th, 1789, how far and how quickly political passions were to drive the hearts of men. There seemed every prospect that the ancient representative body of France would make its terms with the monarchy, which at this stage hardly even a fanatic had dreamt of overthrowing. The hope was that each institution would sustain the other in common purpose, and that France would soon take her place among the growing number of the world's constitutional states. When the deputies went to Mass at Notre Dame on May the 4th, none dreamed that their work would lead to the first of the ruthless dictatorships of modern Europe, which would earn, without cavil, the name of the Terror. Nor did they imagine that their incapacities would prepare the way for the rule of the greatest man of action born in Europe since Julius Caesar. About 1,500 deputies had been elected by 5 million voters under the broadest franchise yet enjoyed by any European country. The clergy and the nobles made their choice separately. The third estate, who numbered half the total assembly, included landed proprietors, men of business, numerous lawyers, doctors, administrators, and members of the other professions. They came to Versailles armed with the complaints of their constituents. Their feelings may be summed up in familiar English terms. Redress of grievances before they would vote supplies to the crown. They represented the middle class. Their property, education, and natural talents gave them a stake in the realm for which they now claimed to exercise a voice. They were disciples of the Enlightenment. Some of them had read Voltaire, Rousseau, and the writings of the encyclopedists. They were well acquainted with abstract reasoning about liberty and equality. Now, within their own practical spheres, they were determined to apply them. A few drew inspiration from the great experiment in democracy taking shape across the Atlantic Ocean. All were intent to assert their rights, not only to be heard, but to take the due part in government so long denied them. The views of the Third Estate were shared by many of the humbler clergy, and a minority of liberal-minded nobles. The opening question for the States General was how it should vote. The Third Estate saw at once that if all three houses met and voted together, there would be a substantial majority for reform. But the court was now awakened to the dangers it had evoked. By compelling the estates to vote separately, it could retain the power to play off the two privileged ones against the third. Urged on by his exigent queen, Louis XVI took action. He called up troops, closed the doors of the Parliament House against the Third Estate, and threatened to dissolve them. By these steps, he brought about the first turning point in the revolution. The Commons were undaunted. They had already changed their name and proclaimed themselves the National Assembly. Faced with locked doors, they now withdrew to an adjoining tennis court, and there, on June the 20th, took the famous oath never to suspend their deliberations and to go on meeting wherever circumstances may dictate until the constitution of the realm is set up and consolidated on firm foundations. thus came into being a single constituent assembly, soon reinforced by its sympathisers among nobles and clergy. Henceforth, the other two estates ceased to exist. At this crisis, the king wavered. He would have liked to use force, but he hesitated to shed blood. His irresolution was compounded of natural lethargy and genuine goodwill. He tried delivering a stern lecture to the deputies. It was of no avail. "No one," he was firmly told by their president, "can give orders to the assembled nation." Not for the last time, Louis gave way. An English commentator on these events has aptly expressed the opinion formed by the world. He was Arthur Young, farmer and student of agriculture, then on a tour of France. "They have at one stroke," he wrote of the assembly, "converted themselves into the Long Parliament of Charles I. It was a prophetic remark. But in France, history was to march faster than it had done in 17th century England. King Louis had only 3 years to live. The scene now shifts to Paris. This great metropolis, with 600,000 inhabitants, had for half a century been the buzzing intellectual capital of the nation. Here, and not amid the stiff ceremonies of Versailles, were focused the hopes, ideas, and ambitions of the French people. Paris was alarmed by the concentration around it of royal troops. Spontaneously, in all its 60 districts, a citizens' militia began to enroll. "Aux armes!" was the cry. There were volunteers in plenty, but few arms. A remedy was quickly found. Early in the morning of July the 14th, a mob forced its way into the Invalides and seized a large stock of muskets and some guns. These were distributed. Now for powder and shot. The capital's main store of powder was lodged in the Bastille, a grim medieval fortress long used as a royal prison. All the morning till past noon, parleys took place with its governor, de Launay. No one knows how fighting started. By treachery or mistake, de Launay fired on the crowd outside, whose leaders bore white flags. His action gave the signal for general assault. Guns were brought up. There was a cannonade. The citizen militia fought with reckless valour, and after 2 hours' struggle, the fortress surrendered. It was immediately sacked, and stone by stone its demolition began. De Launay was murdered, and his bleeding head raised aloft on a pike, a portent of atrocities to come. Thus fell a prime symbol of royal authority. The Bastille held only 7 prisoners, one of them a lunatic, but their release from the cells was hailed throughout France. Louis XVI, the most benevolent of the Bourbons, had hitherto issued no fewer than 14,000 lettres de cachet, consigning his subjects to prison, often with good reason, but always without trial. The fall of the Bastille marked the end of such royal absolutism. It was a triumph for the cause of liberty and for the Parisian mob. With this victory for violence, the revolution had taken a bloody step forward. To the world outside in the summer of 1789, and to foreigners in France, the revolution seemed to have fulfilled its aims. All was over, it was thought. Privilege had been overthrown, the people's rights had been asserted, king and national assembly would settle down to draft a new future for their country. The British ambassador in Paris put a common view when he reported that "the greatest revolution that we know anything of has been effected with the loss of very few lives. From this moment, we may consider France a free country." Burke, meditating in England, was more far-sighted. In his Reflections on the French Revolution, soon to be published, he discerned the shape of things to come. The convulsion in France, as he eloquently pointed out, was not a dignified, orderly change carried out with due regard for tradition like the English Revolution of 1688. A complete break with the past had been made. For 2 years further, the monarchy was to survive while the assembly deliberated upon the ideal constitution under which 25 million Frenchmen and women might freely pursue their affairs. But, in the name of reason, irrational forces had been let loose. These were not easily to be assuaged. France was fated to undergo every form of revolutionary experience. The pattern has been repeated in other countries at later times, but with not very different results. France was the crucible in which all the modern elements of revolution were first put to the test. The king at Versailles was not unduly perturbed by the fall of the Bastille, but its significance was plain to his youngest brother, the Count d'Artois, much later as King Charles X, to be the victim of another revolution. Artois and a following of recalcitrant nobles fled the country. The first emigration of reactionaries then ensued. Some 200,000 members of the nobility and their dependents are said to have asked for their passports during the next 3 months. These émigrés, as they were called, took refuge in Germany and Italy, many at Koblenz and Turin. From beyond the frontiers, they busily intrigued against the new order in France. With them, the king, the queen, and the court were in clandestine correspondence. The National Assembly and the mobs of Paris stood in constant fear that their newly made constitutional king would betray them by joining with the émigrés, and, supported by foreign aid, reimpose the old regime. Nor were their fears groundless. Like Charles I of England, the king counted duplicity as a royal prerogative. He saw nothing wrong in outwardly accepting many distasteful reforms, while secretly, at the instigation of the queen, working for their overturn. Paris was not slow to realize this. Its municipal leaders were now setting the pace. In October, they resolved to recall the king from Versailles and to keep him and the assembly under surveillance and in their midst. In the meantime, the citizens' militia had become the National Guard. Its commander was Lafayette, the hero of the American War of Independence. He was a soldier of high ideals who now cast himself for the role of referee of the revolution. But it was not a game in which there were rules to be observed. On the 5th, a procession of Parisian women set out for Versailles in protest against the high prices of bread. The National Guard, comprising many of their husbands, decided to accompany them. Why should they not? It made for a family outing. Lafayette was reluctantly at their head. At midnight, they reached the palace. There, disorderly scenes took place, and the king and queen were obliged to confront the mob. They bore themselves with dignity. Lafayette gave his personal word that if Louis came to Paris, he would guarantee his safety. The king complied, and on the next day was joyfully received in his capital. Paris had won another victory, and at Versailles the shutters were put up and the blinds drawn for the first time since the reign of Louis XIV. The assembly followed the king back to Paris, but not before some 300 members had resigned or begged leave of absence. Alarmed by the speed of events and fearful for their safety in the capital, they retired to the provinces or went into exile. Already the assembly had decreed the end of feudalism and drawn up a Declaration of the Rights of Man, proclaiming equal citizenship for all. It proceeded to abolish hereditary titles and to nationalize the lands immemorially belonging to the church. These lands were now freely sold and distributed. There came into existence a solid new class of peasant proprietors who owed their all to the revolution. They were to form the backbone of its armies and of those of Napoleon's empire. The zeal of the deputies did not stop at this. They reformed the administration of justice. They turned the clergy, or such of them as would accept the change, into paid servants of state. They wiped off the map the proud old French provinces and parcelled out the country into the 86 departments that still exist. The old regime was torn up by the roots and a new order planted. Compromise was unknown to the men of 89. They would permit no interplay of fruitful assimilation. Europe was amazed and increasingly alarmed by the headlong courses pursued in Paris. Shortly, the principles of the revolution were to reach out from France and be forcibly imposed upon the most ancient states of the continent. The French revolutionary leaders began to dream of spreading the gospel of the brotherhood of man by resort to arms. One figure might perhaps have controlled the swell of events had he been granted the power. The Count de Mirabeau was an ugly, loose-living man who yet possessed within him a true grasp of affairs. Macaulay has well described him thus. Resembling Wilkes in the lower and grosser parts of his character, he had in his higher qualities some affinity to Chatham. Mirabeau towered above his fellow deputies in ability, eloquence, and judgment. For that reason, he aroused widespread jealousy and distrust. Nor would the court listen to him or take his frequently proffered advice. In April 1791, he died, his prodigious ambitions unfulfilled. In him, a man almost of Cromwell's caliber was lost to France. Leadership in the Assembly now passed to demagogues and extremists. First to the Girondins, called after the department round Bordeaux from which their chief men came. Next to the Jacobins, who took their name from a former monastery near the Tuileries, which now supplied them with the amenities of a political club. To all the actions of these zealots, the king had so far assented. He feigned to put up with the position thrust upon him. But though he said yes in public, no was the word in his heart. At his side stood his masterful Habsburg queen, ever convinced that she could and would reverse the march of history. For long the king had been secretly advised to quit Paris, and in some provincial centre rally around himself the conservative elements of the nation. Kings of France had successfully done so before, when Paris became too hot for them. Louis resolved upon a desperate venture. He would escape from his bondage to the northeastern frontier. He would place himself at the head of the émigré, and with the support of Austrian arms, re-establish royal authority. Disguised as a valet, he slipped out of the palace at midnight on June the 20th. He was joined by the queen, dressed as a governess, and by the royal children. Together, in a fast four-horse coach, they drove through the night and throughout the following hot summer day. It was the longest day in the year. Late that evening, at the town of Varennes, 140 miles from Paris and only 30 from the frontier, they missed, by a series of accidents, the loyal escorts awaiting them. While the horses were being changed, Louis showed himself at the window of the coach to get some air. He was recognized by a fervid revolutionary posting master, who identified him from the royal head on the slips of paper money with which he was paid. King, queen, and children were forced to alight, placed under guard, and next day ignominiously conducted back to Paris. The flight had failed, and its failure doomed the monarchy. The chief of state, in the eyes of the revolutionaries, had tried to betray his trust. Nothing now could save him. 18 months of uneasy life lay before Louis. His every action was closely watched. Mobs broke into the Tuileries and insulted him to his face. Soon he was imprisoned, formally deposed, brought to trial as Citizen Capet, and on January the 21st, 1793, executed by the machine of death recently invented by Dr. Guillotin. Courage and dignity walked with him to the last. But as his severed head fell, the Republic triumphed. By now, Europe was at war. A conflict had begun in the previous April, which terminated 23 years later on the field of Waterloo. The anxious Girondin ministers, perpetually looking over their shoulders in dread at the fanatical Jacobins who were to supplant them, had declared war upon Austria. They hoped to buttress their tottering government by a crusade of liberation. Across the Rhine, Austrian, Prussian, and émigré armies had for some time been gathering. Their resounding proclamations threatened the extinction of revolutionary France. Some idle months passed by while the Austrian and Prussian monarchs dismembered Poland and swallowed more of that unhappy republic's territories than they could quickly digest. In the autumn, the invasion of France began. To the world it seemed plain that the hastily assembled French citizen armies would never withstand the professional might of Prussia and Austria. But France was rapidly becoming a nation in arms. The whole country was inspired when General Dumouriez unexpectedly repulsed the Prussians by the cannonade of Valmy. He went on to invade and occupy the Austrian provinces of the Netherlands. At one stroke, the Revolutionary Republic had overrun the lands for which Louis XIV had, for 40 years, struggled in vain. For the first time in history, the entire manpower and resources of a state were being marshalled for total war. New figures came forward to lead and direct the forces of France. Among them was Danton, a figure of tumultuous power and dedicated energy. Robespierre, a ruthless, incorruptible tyrant. Marat, a venomous rabble-rouser of genius. And Carnot, who survived them all, the war minister and organizer of victory. In Dumouriez's army were to be found young, enthusiastic officers and sergeants whose names were to be legends. Ney, Soult, Murat, Lannes, Davout, Marmont, Masséna, Victor, Junot, and Bernadotte. For France, the epoch of her greatest military glory was opening. Before the rest of Europe lay a long ordeal. Chapter 4. France Confronted. In England, the Whigs, and especially the Reformers and Radicals, had at first welcomed the French Revolution. They were soon repelled by its excesses. 18th-century London was not without experience of popular upheavals, but in the Wilkes agitations and the riots of 1780, led by Lord George Gordon, the law had always gained the upper hand over the mob. Now France gave a frightful demonstration of what happens when the social forces unleashed by reformers break free from all control. Most Englishmen recoiled in horror. In the House of Commons, Fox alone, in the broad optimism of his mind, spoke out for the revolution as long as he conscientiously could. For this, he was vehemently attacked by his former friend and ally, Burke, and the number of his faithful followers among the opposition diminished. In the country, similar feelings prevailed. Liberty-loving young men had enthusiastically applauded the events of 1789. "Bliss was it in that dawn to be alive," Wordsworth wrote. Other poets and writers of the fertile new romantic movement shared his views. A few years later, most of them were disillusioned. Some groups of scientists and political thinkers with progressive opinions also gave their allegiance, as they have done in our own day, to foreign revolutionary ideas. At the meetings of their societies, they toasted the 14th of July and the French Constitution. But they were only a small leaven amid the solid English conservative mass. More dangerous were the radical working men's clubs, which were springing up in the principal towns, generally under middle-class leadership. They kept up a close correspondence with the Jacobins in Paris, and fraternal delegates were sent to the National Assembly and its successor, the Convention. These agitators formed a small but vociferous minority of the British public, and eventually the government took drastic action against them. Such was the scene in Britain as the idea of world revolution gathered force in Paris. The unprovoked massacre of political prisoners by the new rulers of France in 1792 was a further shock to the faith of many would-be revolutionaries in the United Kingdom. The execution of the French king in January 1793 was a supreme act of defiance. In his celebrated speech, Danton summarized the French revolutionary attitude. "Allied kings threaten us, and we hurl at their feet as a gauge of battle the head of a king." Marat cried, "We must establish the despotism of liberty to crush the despotism of kings." The French Republican armies were a threat not only to the Austrian and Prussian enemy, but also to their own government. It was essential that they should be kept in the field. As a Girondin minister put it frankly, "Peace is out of the question. We have 300,000 men in arms. We must make them march as far as their legs will carry them, or they will return and cut our throats." In his budget speech of 1792, Pitt had announced that he believed in 15 years of peace for Europe. Non-intervention was his policy. Something more vital to Britain than a massacre of aristocrats or a speech in the convention, something more concrete than a threat of world revolution, had to happen before he would face the issue of war. The spark, as so often in England's history, came from the Netherlands. By November, the French decree instructing their generals to pursue the retreating Austrians into any country in which they might take refuge was a clear threat to the neutrality of Holland. A second pronouncement declared the navigation of the Scheldt open between Antwerp and the sea. A week later, French men of war were bombarding the citadel of Antwerp, and on November the 28th, the city fell into French hands. The whole delicate balance of 18th-century international politics was deranged. In a note to the French ambassador on December the 31st, Lord Grenville, the Foreign Secretary, stated the position of His Majesty's government in words which have ever since been accepted as a classic exposition of English foreign policy. England will never consent that France shall arrogate the power of annulling at her pleasure, and under the pretense of a pretended natural right, of which she makes herself the only judge, the political system established by solemn treaties and guaranteed by the consent of all the powers. This government, adhering to the maxims which it has followed for more than a century, will also never see with indifference that France shall make herself, either directly or indirectly, sovereign of the Low Countries, or general arbiter of the rights and liberties of Europe. If France is really desirous of maintaining friendship and peace with England, she must show herself disposed to renounce her views of aggression and aggrandizement, and to confine herself within her own territory, without insulting other governments, without disturbing their tranquillity, without violating their rights. On the last day of January 1793, the French Convention, with Danton's defiant speech in their ears, decreed the annexation of the Austrian Netherlands to the French Republic. The next day, France declared war on Great Britain and Holland, firm in the belief that an internal revolution in England was imminent. Pitt now had no choice. English security was imperiled by French occupation of the Flemish coast, and particularly the Scheldt estuary. Trade with the continent would be endangered, and the English Channel was no longer safe. But for this deliberate provocation from Paris, Pitt might have avoided the issue a little longer. But now, with the southern Netherlands in French hands, and with world revolution in view, the threat was direct and inescapable. In a speech in the House of Commons in March, Pitt, in sorrow, produced his first proposals for war finance, and outlined the causes of the conflict. "Many are the motives which have induced us to enter into war. I have heard of wars of honour, and such too have been deemed wars of prudence and policy. On the present occasion, whatever can raise the feelings or animate the exertions of a people concurs to prompt us to the contest. The contempt which the French have shown for a neutrality on our part most strictly observed, the violations of their solemn and plighted faith, their presumptuous attempts to interfere in the government of this country, and to arm our subjects against ourselves, to vilify a monarch, the object of our gratitude, reverence, and affection, and to separate the court from the people, by representing them as influenced by different motives and acting from different interests. After provocation so wanton, so often repeated, and so highly aggravated, does not this become, on our part, a war of honour? A war necessary to assert the spirit of the nation and the dignity of the British name. I have heard of wars undertaken for the general security of Europe. Was it ever so threatened as by the progress of the French arms and the system of ambition and aggrandizement which they have discovered? I have heard of wars for the defence of the Protestant religion. Our enemies in this instance are equally enemies of all religion, of Lutheranism, of Calvinism, and desirous to propagate everywhere, by the force of their arms, that system of infidelity which they avow in their principles. I have heard of wars undertaken in defence of the lawful succession, but now we fight in defence of our hereditary monarchy. We are at war with those who would destroy the whole fabric of our constitution. When I look at these things, they afford me encouragement and consolation, and support me in discharging the painful task to which I am now called by my duty. The retrospect to that flourishing state in which we were placed previous to this war ought to teach us to know the value of the present order of things, and to resist the malignant and envious attempts of those who would deprive us of that happiness which they despair themselves to attain. We ought to remember that that very prosperous situation at the present crisis supplies us with the exertions and furnishes us with the means which our exigencies demand. In such a cause as that in which we are now engaged, I trust that our exertions will terminate only with our lives. On this ground, I have brought forward the resolutions which I am now to propose, and on this ground, I now trust for your support. Britain was to be at war for over 20 years, and was now confronted with the task of making a major war effort, with her armed forces more crippled, perhaps, than at any time before, by lack of equipment, leaders, and men. The conditions of service and the administration of the army and navy were so appalling that it is wonderful that anything was achieved at all. Pitt himself knew nothing of war or strategy, and the conduct of military affairs fell largely upon Henry Dundas, who was first and foremost a businessman. In the old tradition of the 18th century, he advocated a colonial and trade war, which would be popular among the mercantile classes and produce some commercial returns. For several years, British resources were dissipated in ill-manned and ill-planned expeditions to the West Indies. It was with the greatest difficulty that any men could be raised for these mistaken enterprises. If Britain had possessed even a small effective army, it would not have been difficult, in concert with allies moving from the Rhine, to strike from the French coast at Paris and overthrow the government responsible for provoking the conflict. But Pitt was barely able to send 5,000 men to help his Dutch allies protect their frontiers from invasion. The campaigning which followed was no credit to British arms. An attempt to take Dunkirk ended lamentably. By 1795, the British forces on the continent were driven back upon the mouth of the Ems on the German border, whence they were evacuated home. Great hopes had been founded in London upon the French royalists, who launched daring schemes to arrest the revolution by civil war in France. In 1793, they seized Toulon. And but for the fact that Dundas had already assigned all available troops to the West Indies, a vital base for future invasion might have been secured. Something else happened at Toulon. A young lieutenant of the French army, sprung from a leading Corsican family, well versed in artillery and other military matters, happening to be on leave from his regiment, looked in on the camp of General Carteaux, who commanded the Jacobin besieging army. He walked along the line of batteries, and pointed out that their shot would not reach halfway. This error was adjusted, and the expert lieutenant began to have a say at that incompetent headquarters. Presently orders arrived from Paris, prescribing the method of siege according to customary forms, for which, however, the necessary material resources were lacking. None dared dispute the instructions of the terrible Committee of Public Safety, which was now at the head of French affairs. Nevertheless, at the Council of War held in daylight on bare ground, the expert lieutenant raised his voice. The orders, he said, or so he claimed later, were foolish, and all knew it. There was, however, a way of taking Toulon. He placed his finger on the map where Fort L'Aiguillette, on its promontory, commanded the entrance to the harbour. "There is Toulon," he said, and all, taking their lives in their hands, obeyed him. He organised and led the assault upon Fort L'Aiguillette. After a hot fight, it fell. The whole wide front of the Toulon defences, manned by thousands of royalists, remained intact, and the feeble lines of the besiegers gazed upon it from a safe distance. But on the morning after Fort L'Aiguillette fell, the British fleet was seen to be leaving the harbour. The lieutenant had understood not only the military significance of the captured fort, but the whole set of moral and political forces upon which the Royalist defence at Toulon hung. Once the British fleet had departed, all resisting power perished. There was a stampede to escape upon such vessels as remained. The city surrendered, and horrible vengeance was wreaked upon thousands of helpless captives, who might have been the vanguard of counter-revolution. When these matters were reported to Robespierre and his brother and the committee in Paris, they thought they would like to know more about this competent and apparently well-disposed lieutenant. His name was Napoleon Bonaparte, and after all, he had taken Toulon. Meanwhile, the terror rose to its height, and in the political frenzy of Paris no one knew when his hour would come. Men and women went by 40s and 50s every day to the guillotine. In self-preservation, politicians and people combined against Robespierre. It was July the 27th, 1794, or by the new French reckoning, the 9th Thermidor of the year 2, for the revolutionaries had decided to tear up the calendar of Julius Caesar and Pope Gregory and start afresh. On that day, in a furious convulsion, Robespierre was dragged down and sent where he would have sent the rest. Our lieutenant of Toulon fame was cast back by this event. He was associated with the Robespierres. He was their maker of plans. By a spin of the coin, he might have followed them into the shades. But the extremity of the terror had died with Robespierre, and the directorate which succeeded soon had need of him. In 1795, a strong movement to set up a respectable government led to an armed rising in the well-to-do quarters of Paris. One of the members of the directorate, Barras, all being in dire peril, remembered the lieutenant who'd taken Toulon. Placed in command of the military forces, Bonaparte planted his cannon around the legislature, and scattered the citizens who declared they were seeking a free and fair election in accordance with the public will. This cannonade of the 13th Vendémiaire, October the 4th, was the second leap upward of Bonaparte. On its morrow, he claimed command of the French army against the Austrians in northern Italy. He animated his ragged and famishing troops by the hopes of glory and of booty. He led them in 1796 through the passes of the Alps into a smiling, fertile, and as yet unravaged land. In a series of most hazardous minor battles, gained at heavy odds, he routed the Austrian commanders and conquered the broad base of the Italian peninsula. By these victories, he outstripped all rivals in the military field and became the sword of the revolution, which he was determined to exploit and to destroy. This was the third phase. Corsican, Jacobin, General were milestones he'd left behind him. He now saw as his next step nothing less than a conquest of the Orient after the fashion of Alexander the Great. He planned the invasion of Egypt as a preliminary to the capture of Constantinople and all that lay in Asia. In England, the government had been forced to take repressive measures of a sternness unknown for generations. Republican lecturers were swept into prison. The Habeas Corpus Act was suspended. Distinguished writers were put on their trial for treason. But juries could not be prevailed on to convict. The mildest criticism of the Constitution brought the Speaker under danger from a new Treason Act. Ireland, governed since 1782 by a Protestant Parliament independent of Westminster, was now on the verge of open rebellion, which, as Pitt saw, could only be averted by liberal concessions to the Irish Catholics. Henry Grattan, the eloquent Irish leader, who'd done so much to win more freedom for his country, urged that Catholics should be given both a vote and the right to sit in Parliament and hold office. They got the vote, but seats in Parliament were still denied them. Few victories came to brighten these dark years. In 1794, the French Channel Fleet, ill-equipped and under-officered, was half-heartedly engaged by Admiral Howe. 3 years later, off Cape St. Vincent, the Spanish fleet, Spain being now in alliance with France, was soundly beaten by Jarvis and Nelson. But such had been the neglect of conditions of service in the Navy that the ships at Spithead refused to put to sea. The movement spread to the Nore, and for some weeks London was in effect blockaded by the British fleet, while a French squadron was on the high seas making for Ireland on a vain quest. The men were entirely loyal. Indeed, on the King's birthday, the salute which they fired was so hearty, and the guns so well charged, that the fortifications of Sheerness tumbled down. Some slight concessions satisfied the mutineers, and they retrieved their honour in a handsome victory off Camperdown over the Dutch, who were now satellites of France. Meanwhile, the Bank of England had suspended cash payments. On the continent, the French were everywhere triumphant. Bonaparte, having reduced northern Italy, was preparing to strike at Austria through the Alpine passes. In April 1797, he signed with her the Preliminaries of Leoben, converted some months later into the Treaty of Campo Formio. Belgium was annexed to France. The Republic of Venice, with a glorious history reaching into the Dark Ages, became an Austrian province. Milan, Piedmont, and the little principalities of northern Italy were welded into a new Cisalpine Republic. France, dominant in Western Europe, firmly planted in the Mediterranean, safeguarded against attack from Germany by a secret understanding with Austria, had only to consider what she would conquer next. A sober judgment might have said England by way of Ireland. Bonaparte thought he saw his destiny in a larger field. In the spring of 1798, he sailed for Egypt. Nelson sailed after.